accession number 22346, reel 3.
Captain Riggs, reel 3.
You were saying the platoon sergeant majors were generally good quality.
Well, they were the senior, usually company sergeant majors. Mm. Considered something slightly less than an RSM, of course.
Yes.
But only less likely than CSMs were thought less than an RSM.
Yeah.
And they were great guys. Many of them had long service and with the battalion, with the regiment. And we had about half a dozen at one time throughout the battalion. But one of them in my company was a platoon sergeant major. He'd been a mate at sea beforehand, but that's another story, I think.
Rather surprising he hadn't joined the Navy.
Well, no, he joined the Army long before the war, so he would have volunteered.
Yes.
And went into the Bedfords. And so he sometimes, since he was a mate in the merchant Navy. And he was commissioned later on anyway. But that was the make-up. How many men we had in the company or in the platoons then, I really don't remember, but you know, the impression I get is no more like 20 than the statutory 30-ish, which was the normal, proper establishment of a rifle platoon at that time.
And what sort of internal security precautions were you doing in Jerusalem? Was it mainly patrols or static guards?
No, more static. As usual, we had an emergency platoon standing by in the barracks,
yes.
Armed and vehicled and ready to move at any time in case there was any trouble. But it never was called out, as far as I remember. Not there. We did something of that kind later on elsewhere, but I can mention that later. As I say, we were pretty short of subalterns. One was commanding the emergency platoon, of course. One was on the government house guard, because you had to have an officer guard with the governor there, like a royal guard. As I say, one or two orderly officers on, going around checking the guards at force headquarters and the hospitals and wherever else we had guards. And of course, if an officer was put under close arrest, he had to have an officer
guarding
with him.
Mm.
And so very occasionally we got caught for that. And when one or two of us were off on courses, there were no subalterns left. No such thing as a subaltern with the time off. So we didn't get very much spare time. But occasionally, I say, where we could, we'd go off and hopefully go down to the coast and have a swim, and if we could bundle a few of us together, sometimes with the families, you know.
What was the situation like in Jerusalem? Did it differ from that which had prevailed in Nablus?
No, it was very much the same. It was the same all over Palestine. It was peaceful, it was quiet, no trouble. Nobody threw a rock at anybody or anything like that. And except for being armed, we could move around all right. When we weren't on duty, we could go and have a drink in the King David Hotel and something to eat there if we wanted to. There were a lot of families about, so that you know, one could get together. We had parties parties, not drinking parties.
Yes,
I mean,
gather
parties and have dinner in groups and that sort of thing. Armed, of course, with our sidearms, but...
So you had no incidents to cope with?
Hmm?
You had no incidents to cope with?
No.
As you can remember.
Nobody drew a gun when you were drunk in the King David Hotel that I knew about. I had I mentioned that I was at a choir school. In fact, somebody who was there long before me, I'm talking about St. Paul's Cathedral Choir School in London here. A guy who was there long before me was a man called George Haddingham, who by this time was quite a senior man in the Palestine police. He was a sort of deputy commander in the Jerusalem area. So I used to go and see him and his wife and that sort of thing. And I could go out alone and do this without breaking orders or hazard at all. So it was much more free moving about when you could, than it would have been in 1936 and 1938, when you always had to go out in groups. So that was the state of play in Jerusalem. And we were there It was while I was there that I was told that I was to take over the signal platoon of the battalion. Now, this again was a sort of about platoon size of about 25 men, I suppose. So perhaps I better try to tell you about a battalion signal platoon at the time. Its equipment was pretty rudimentary. We had no radios to start with, so that's easily disposed of. No wireless sets. Until later. We had 8 telephones and about 8 miles of cable, single-strand cable with earth pins at each end that you stuck into the ground, of which thereby hangs a tail as well, but I'll come back to that in a moment. But we also, we had, of course, all the guys had to learn Morse, the Morse code, because the speech would only work on these field telephones over a rather short distance. And so we always, and particularly in a very dry country like that, the earth's return on the electrical circuits was never very good. So we all learned Morse keys. We had, for a while, we had heliographs, 6-inch mirrors, tripods, and they were great fun. From the top of one hill to the top of the next. You know, we never really used them very much, but they were issued, so we had them. I think they used them quite a bit on the northwest frontier and places like that.
How far could you actually signal with a
heliograph? Well, they said in that sort of climate, when there was sort of clear sunshine, but the heliograph, I think you could do 6 or 8, 10 miles. It wasn't an easy thing to work, because it was a Morse code you had to send, and if it got slightly off pointing in exactly the right direction, remember that you had to move it as the sun moved, you got a double tap. And you couldn't read it the far end.
Yes.
I can't remember the mechanism of it, but it had a little sort of shadow thing that you had to keep on lined up somewhere. Yes. So that you knew it was pointing exactly at the guy to whom you were trying to communicate.
On the right bearing.
Absolutely, but it had to be absolutely precise. Otherwise, because the Morse code was sent by moving, but you pressed a key, but it moved the mirror.
Yes.
So you could do a dot and a dash by moving the mirror. And, of course, if you got it wrong, the guy at the other end would get a double flash for either a dot or a dash, and then, of course, he couldn't read it. And a certain amount of rudery flew backwards and forwards until that was adjusted. But we didn't use it very much. It was almost a toy. They did have them in Egypt, I'm told. They had one on the top of the pyramids. Well, that was the Royal Signals had that, and it was a big one, about 14-inch mirror. And I think with one intermediate station, they could go right through to Aswan. You tell me how many miles that is.
Hundreds of miles. Yes, hundreds of miles.
And it's all right if you can get elevated, of course, because
yes.
Then you can you haven't got to cope with the curvature of the earth as so much as you have a ground level.
How tall were the tripods that yours were on?
Oh, only shoulder high.
Shoulder high.
Yes, but they needed to be very steady, of course.
Anchored into the
yes.
ground.
Rather like theodolite tripods,
yes.
You can't have them wiggling about when you're trying to take a reading. And but they were quite amusing. And of course, it was good for the guys. You could say, okay, 2 minutes, top of the hill, and you could send some others up that way. And then you'd give them. It helped them to learn the Morse code as well. But it was a diversion in the actual grinding away through,
the Morse
dot dot dash 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 and what have you.
How did you choose your signalers when you...
Well, they were there in the signal platoon when I got
yes.
them. I didn't select them. They tend to have to be the guys who are a bit more literate than others, needless to say, because, they had to take script and transmit it by Morse code. And so they weren't the real dullards of the... they were in the sort of rifle sections and good guys, but... somebody who had to be able to cope with being able to write and a little, we would have had very low grade ciphers if we had any at all. And what they were, I just can't remember. More a string of code names rather than, a proper enciphering and deciphering process, of which more a year or two later on.
Did you go on the signals course that you mentioned before you took over the platoon or afterwards?
Very early on, anyway. I spent, you know, some time taking over from the guy who was the signal officer at the time.
What happened to him?
In fact, he used to teach me to... he became a company commander, I think. He got promoted. He was a regular. But he used to spend hours teaching me the Morse code. We'd take one of these field telephones. In fact, he was in the next door room to me in the barracks. And so he could, with a bit of cabling, it was hot in the afternoon and we weren't too busy. He could keep me awake by making me try to read at eight words a minute. And so I needed to get hold of it faster than my own guys because in the daytime I had to be trying to train them. And when we wanted to give them a bit of drill, we used to take flags out. And we could learn the Morse code by, not like semaphore flags, but just by dot, dash, dot, dot, like that.
Were these a particular type of flag?
No, they're just a blue and white flags on a bit of stick, you know, with blue and white being the Royal Signals colours. We had no Royal Signals with us. Yeah. They were only at a brigade.
Well,
we hadn't got a brigade at that time, but they'd have been a force headquarters and that sort of thing. And... so that was fun, and I was the battalion signal officer for quite a while, and I'll come on to later on. And so that's really all about the signal platoon and what it had to do. while we were in Jerusalem, and before I became a signal officer, I was sent off on the detachment. Now, this could be something worth noting. I was sent off to a small Christian Arab town about 10, 12-something miles north of Jerusalem, along the top of the hills, where there was the transmitter for the Palestine radio.
Was it civil radio?
It was the civil radio, yes. Mm. But we had to put a guard on it. Mm. And so we were billeted, a platoon was sent out there. We were billeted in a building which was wired in a bit. Again, going back to the time of the Troubles more than anything else. And we lived out there as a platoon. It had the White Horse Inn, it was called, because I think the West Yorkshires were there before us sometime or other, some months before. And this was the little Christian Arab town of Ram Allah, which one sees on the... on the news a great deal today, where there's a huge amount of trouble. But there were no Israelis there. They were all Christians. The school was Methodists, I think, ran the schools there and the little local hospital. And it was entirely peaceful. I had an interpreter, but I used to give the prizes away at the girls' school sports as the local military commander, still only 20 and a second lieutenant. And read the lesson on Sunday in the Methodist Church. And there was a Palestine police post there, two or three guys, and I used to go out with them. Because we had 21 villages all around Ramallah.
Were they within your...
which were within our parish, if you like. Mm. And we used to go out visiting three or four or five or six of them with a Palestine policeman and say, how do you do to the Mukhtar? The headman of the village, you know, and pass the time of day. And very occasionally, in one of the bigger villages, you might find that it actually killed a sheep and had cooked it with some rice and what have you, and we were asked to join them. I was usually only out with a section of about five or six guys. There were not a lot of us. But, of course, the trouble is when you eat... with Arabs. You ate with your hands, of course. And I had to remember, particularly as I'm extremely left-handed, that you never ate with your left hand for reasons perhaps on a tape I better not explain. But the other thing was, of course, the guest of honour, once you'd had one or two glasses of arak, which is this very strong aniseed liqueur, and not all that well distilled, you were then presented, as the guest of honour, you were then presented with the sheep's eye to eat. So I've only once eaten a sheep's eye.
What's it
with
like?
With another good slug of arak to go down with it. Didn't taste of anything at all very much.
Didn't.
No. But you didn't look it in the eye before you ate it. You just popped it in, hope for the best. But that was the sort of thing. Anyway, we got on all right. We liked the Arabs, and they had a sense that they liked us, particularly the guys out in the villages, you know, who were, they just wanted to be left alone. They were peasants. Okay, and during the times of the Troubles, there were the odd hothead who no doubt hid in the villages, and at times they had to take some action against them. But luckily, fortunately, we never had to do anything of the kind. It was quiet.
What sort of guard did you have to maintain on the transmitter? I mean, how many men would you have in the...
Well, the silly thing was the transmitter was about 200 yards away from where we were, and yes. I don't think we ever put a guard on it at all.
It sounds like you were just maintaining a...
We were just nearby, yes. And perhaps in the days of when the West Yorkshires, the White Horse, were there, maybe they did have to put an infantry section around it all the time. As a more formal sort of protection, but it wasn't necessary in our time. Or I presumably we were very much guided by the Palestine police about what sort of protection or guarding we should do. I don't remember having had a discussion, but you know, I wouldn't have known whether to put the whole platoon on there or just one man.
When you were out there on that detachment of Ramallah, how did you keep in touch with the company?
Well, there was a civil telephone, if I remember rightly. But I must tell you a bit more about these field telephones, because we did have a couple of our own signallers out there, and probably what we did, you see, in a signal platoon, it was a sweat having to, on reels, a couple of you, to have to lay out a mile of cable or whatever it might have been. It was far better if you could get up a civilian pole and clip in to each end of it, and then put your earth pin down.
So you would hook it into the civil network.
That's right. But you use the civil line, and put your earth pins in, and then you could talk to one another, and you didn't have to and reel back in.
Yes.
All your cable, because it's the cable was copper. But it had the old braided insulation on it. And the more you reeled it out and brought it back, the more you had short circuits, because the braiding and insulation... There were no plastics in those days. It didn't exist.
It was cloth, wasn't it, the insulation?
It was cloth with rubber.
And it would wear
and, of
away.
Course, that wore out easily. Mm. And so the less you actually reeled out your cable, the better, apart from the sweat of having to reel it. But it was rather unfortunate, because on one occasion we didn't realize that the radio transmitter was going along a line. They were transmitting from Jerusalem to the transmitter and out to the world on the ordinary radio transmitter. We didn't realize we'd clicked into this telephone line, and some of our guys talking to one another were coming up with one or two things that were rather unsuitable for transmission to the world. And on one famous occasion, and fortunately it was before I had the signal platoon, somewhere or another they had done this, and there was a transmission going out on the radio. And what you used to say to the guy at the other end who couldn't hear him very well was, water your earth pin to get a better electrical connection in very dry ground. It was not expressed quite in such a polite way, water your earth pin. But this came over on the radio. And of course it was all hell let loose then. Much fury. And I don't know how that one was cleaned up and covered up. But as I said, it was before my time. But now I've overshot into the signal world. But there wasn't very much else at Ramallah. Again, completely peaceful. I'd go into the town, as I say, people would say hello to me, you know, as being the sort of the military commander of Ramallah. And they got to know my face anyway. I say, I used to give the prizes away at the girls' school sports and that sort of thing. And the interpreter was very good, obviously, the way he linked us up with the local population.
Local?
He was a Palestinian, yes. or half Egyptian, half Palestinian, I think.
Was he from Ramallah or was he from?
No, he wasn't. I mean, all over the place. We hired, the army hired interpreters, and he was allocated to me for this detachment in Ramallah. It was a very happy month or two I had out there, and then another platoon came out and swapped over. But it was an interesting little interlude, again, for somebody still fairly pink and just out from home and still very, very young. So back to barracks at Allenby Barracks, and then, as I say, the signal, then I was taking over the signal platoon. So this takes me through then to the end of 1940. And in January, they decided we better try to do some battalion training. And the only place where you could do that was down on the Dead Sea, or north of the Dead Sea, between the north of the Dead Sea and Jericho. So we went down there, and we went into a sort of tented camp down there and tried to do some battalion exercises, which of course exercised me as the signal platoon commander at that stage, and I was wearing out my cable quite a bit. As usual, very stony ground, nothing like the huge agriculture they must have down on the Dead Sea now. There were no kibbutz or anything of that sort. And so we did some battalion exercises there. In fact, the Royal Scots Greys were next door to us there, still with their horses.
Did you have any joint exercises with them?
No, I don't think we did, because they were mainly doing some patrolling further north. They didn't really know what to do with the cavalry division. Have you ever had anybody from the cavalry division talk to you? So you'll know roughly their role, hanging around waiting to be put into tanks, to put it crudely. Yes. But they still had all their horses there, many of them, and they were doing anti-drug smuggling patrols on the border with Syria and Jordan mainly. But some of them were based down in the Jordan Valley around Jericho and, well, all over. And but just by the by, they happened to be next door to us there, but I don't think there was no sort of training with them of any kind went on.
What sort of training did the battalion do? What sort of things were they
practicing? Well, mainly, I think it was trying to train the CO and the second in command and the company commanders on deploying a whole battalion and, I don't know, putting them into an attack somewhere. As I should remember being the signal platoon, because I was at battalion headquarters,
you were
of course,
at
that
things,
time.
Weren't you?
I should have known of being in the hub of things. Frankly, I don't quite remember what we did do. I remember we had a second in command there who had been drafted into us, and he didn't have much idea. But luckily, he didn't last very long. He went off somewhere else.
What did battalion headquarters consist of, besides you with the signals platoon?
Well, there was the CO, there was the second in command, the RSM, you know, and the odd clerk and so on, the intelligence officer who had one. He had a section, intelligence section, I think, two or three chaps, and my signal platoon, some of which would have been out with the rifle company headquarters.
Yours were always deployed in little detachments, weren't they? Your soldiers would always be out in little detachments, two company headquarters.
Yes, that was mainly mainly their deployment was with the company headquarters and the rest back with the battalion. But I had the headquarters. I probably had most of them because I had the linesmen there.
Yes.
And either they would be told to run a line out to, if ever we got static, run a line out to the company headquarters, or go and reel it in because we were going to move. Yeah. This went on and on.
What sort of exchange system did you have?
I don't remember. We must have had an exchange of some kind, but it had been a very rudimentary thing. I mean, there was no idea of the companies being linked to one another at all.
So there was no lateral communication?
No,
it was all up
no,
to
not at that stage.
Again.
Later on, and I'll tell you about that later on in a different context.
Did you have a formal sort of signals office?
No, there was me, and I suppose I had a clerk and who would keep some sort of paperwork going. Mm. We had...
You had signals logs.
Regular signal pads, and I'm sure we would have kept a log, and indeed probably kept notes of the signals that were coming and going. Because, of course, we had to be geared up for some sort of tie-up backwards to brigade.
Yeah, rear link.
We had motorcycles. Dispatch riders. I probably had, in my signal platoon, I probably had half a dozen motorcycles, one of which I used to get on myself whenever I could, of course, particularly if you were hungover in a hot climate. It was good to go for a ride on a motorcycle, shake yourself up. But also they did more serious things. They were actually doing jobs as dispatch riders because, you know, the cable work was often didn't make much sense, particularly if the battalion was on the move in any way at all.
What sort of motorcycles Nortons. Did you have?
We had Norton motorcycles, which were fine, pretty heavy things. But in a hot climate, you burnt quite a lot driving those things. You know, always roll down the sleeves on your shirts. You know, yes. Otherwise your arms got absolutely cooked. And yes, we had half a dozen of those motorcycles. I must have had also a pickup truck, I think, probably I must have had, with some of my signal gear in it.
1,500 weight, probably.
Yes, that's right, yes, yes, yes.
You're mentioning the effects of the sun and your arms being cooked. Were there any other hazards to health that you had to be particularly aware of in Palestine at that time?
No. I mean, you know, I used to get cases of diarrhea and that sort of thing, mainly through water being not so good and what have you, but nothing serious. If one did get dysenteries, it was usually the bacillary dysentery and not the very nasty amoebic dysentery, of which a bit more later on, because we were, as I said, mainly in static camp organizations or in barracks, in which case, you know, the hygiene was pretty good. It was quite adequate, and so you didn't get these epidemic diseases too much, or pick up. We always had these chlorine tablets
for the water purification.
Yeah, if we ever managed to pick up water out of a stream or out of a well anywhere when we were out in the hills, you know, you'd put a chlorine tablet in and shake it up for 2 minutes, nominally, unless you were busting with thirst, in which case you drank it anyhow. And then you put another tablet in, which was supposed to neutralize the chlorine. I'm sure next door they've got some examples of this. A little two-bottle pack you had.
Still in use in the 1980s.
Yeah.
Chlorine tablet and a
thiosulfate. And then something which neutralized it, more or less.
Yeah. Thiosulfate, I think, was the second
I can't
thing.
Remember yes. what the chemical was, but... Yeah.
You did mention scorpions when you were out in the country going on.
Well, that's right, yes. There were scorpions around in Palestine, yeah. You know, if you were sleeping out in the hills. And that and what we used to call spear grass, that used to put sort of seeds into your socks and you couldn't pull it out, you know, because it had a sort of fishhook end on it. And if you got a few of those into your boot when you had marched a few miles in the heat, it was... It was all right. I mean, it didn't. A bit more marching in with no boots later on, but. And I suppose there were the odd snakes around, but most times, you know, unless you happen to tread on one in the middle of the night, you were. And a bit more about that later on in India, but scorpions were the trouble in Palestine. We were always told in the morning, if you'd slept out and you'd taken your boots off. To bang it out, and so you didn't shove your foot in there with a yeah. scorpion down at the end, because then you did know what it was all about. They weren't deadly, but they were extremely painful if they bit you. I never got bitten by one, but no doubt there was the odd case here and there. Otherwise, there was not much in the way of livestock to cause problems at all. I mean, we were never sort of... in the same clothes for days on end, so we never gathered fleas. But some more of those later on, indeed.
do you know how long the battalion was down on the Dead Sea doing it?
Yes, I do. We were there from January, February,